Hello and welcome to the BA Brew. I'm Mike.
I'm Pete.
And I'm Mick.
And today on the BA Brew, we're talking about the implementation of artificial intelligence within an organization. So we're very pleased to welcome Mick to the brew to talk about his experiences and share with us sort of hints and tips from his background. So Mick, would you like to give us a bit of an introduction to what you've been doing with artificial intelligence?
Yeah, certainly. So I'm Mick Bryan. I'm the head of change for CMC, and luckily enough, over the past 2 years, I've had the sort of fantastic opportunity to get involved with the adoption and integration of AI. It's a vast, vast thing, but when I say I'm lucky, what I mean by that is, when ChatGPT came out, when it became a thing, I thought, this looks quite interesting. I'm going to sort of sign up here. So I literally signed up the next day and then got a free account, which was lucky because about 3 days after that, you couldn't get a free account. So I think when you look back in history, there's going to, for most people, AI almost starts, obviously it goes way back, but it almost starts for most people when it became a real thing that was tangible, is when ChatGPT was released. So there's going to be a day before ChatGPT and almost like a day after ChatGPT. And that's what I felt like. So I'd been using it for about 6 months. And then fortunately, I got the opportunity to be involved in a project where they needed to get a large language model into a large organization. And it was a bit of a wake-up call, really, because everybody saw what was going on, and there was a directive that we need to understand what this means for the organization. So that's a bit of background as to how I got involved in that project. And from there, what's interesting from a BA perspective is from the very beginning of that, it became apparent that there was going to have to be business analyst input into how we did it. And the reason for that is it wasn't done, nobody had done it before. Mm. So there wasn't a best practice thing you could take and say, this is what we're going to do. It was really, really, it's probably, I know the agile word, you know, go on LinkedIn these days and you see about a million posts about agile being dead and all these things. And, you know, but if I look at it, I would genuinely say it's probably the most agile project I've ever been involved in. And the BAs had like a real role in that, because we did really have to experiment with what we were doing. So we literally started with that question: how do we get a large language model? Was the first question. So we sort of worked that out, managed to do that. And what we then decided was, right, we're going to, this isn't just a technical problem, which I think, again, we all know this is a people problem as well, because you can get all this stuff into an organization. If no one uses it, well, you know, I think we've all been involved in projects where that's happened before. So the BAs really sort of steered us into having this experimental MVP approach. So we did just a quick 8-week sort of sprint, if you like. And we split it into 2 weeks, and then we would deliver something every 2 weeks. And the really important thing, I think, around this is the business analysts involved were really on the ball in relation to, it's not the technology that's going to trip you up here. It's the things around policies, legality, ethics, security. It's all these like enabling functions that was a thing that caused the most problems.
Yeah, that's quite a good link into Poppit, really, isn't it? Because you can think very much focus on the technology bit, but actually the technology is probably only half the battle. Well, is it half the battle?
Yeah.
It might be less than that.
I think for a lot of projects, technology is almost the easy bit, isn't it? It's all the other things that take the time and that cause all the problems and things, if they're not done properly anyway, downstream.
Yeah, 100%.
But that curiosity led on to something. At what point did you start to think, right, well, there are some real opportunities here, and how did that sort of build from there?
Yeah. So after the 8 weeks, what we really did was we really focused on one of the things we said was we weren't going to look at any more than three use cases, right? So it wasn't trying to, you know, do a massive collection of 400 use cases or anything like that. It was like we're going to focus on three use cases and potentially see if the large language model can give us any benefit in relation to these three use cases. Actually, at the end of the eight weeks, it was one use case. It was literally one use case. Yeah. And from that, what we did, we then scaled it and give like about 50 people access to it and said, can you sort of have a go at that solving this one use case that we have, given your expertise? But these people were from lots of different areas. You know, people in, that were from a technical background, with the BAs were still involved, all the legal policy, ethics, security, and see if we can solve this one use case. And after a period of about, we carried on then for about a period of about 2 months, we then did, we were doing continuous feedback, just give us feedback on what you're finding. And after that 2 months, it was very evident that people were getting some sort of benefit from the large language model. Now, I'll probably cover this a bit later on, and this is an ongoing conversation now around what is the benefit and what is the value of this type of technology. If you're working in government at the minute, everything is focused on cost. It will save us money. It will save us time. It will be productivity gains. And actually, I went to the AWS public sector event last week, and nearly every session I went to, everyone was saying those are the wrong metrics and benefits to look at, because it will what you'll end up with is a generative AI will be an automation tool, not a like transformative tool for people. The value to me, my 15 minutes of time saving, maybe 30 minutes to Peter, maybe 3 hours to Mike. It's very, very difficult to quantify this stuff. And when you talk about value, some of the value people were getting out of it was, oh, it makes me think about a problem slightly differently. I use the large language model as a critical friend, all this type of stuff.
And of course, these are some of the intangible things, aren't they? You know, you can't measure these. It's not always useful to try and measure them, not in terms of a tangible thing, but they are worthwhile as well. You know, and it's almost impossible to put a value on that, as you say, in monetary terms. So I think there's a wider point there, isn't there, that goes beyond just AI, you know, that organizations do try and get very focused on all the money, saving money and whatever else. They can miss opportunities, perhaps, as a consequence of that. Anyway, I'm starting to digress.
It's a really valid point. Actually, one of the bits of work that we're on to now is actually trying to come up with some sort of value framework. Again, it's so difficult, because if you go on to any of these, you know, be it OpenAI, Google, Meta, whatever, whoever's got a large language model, the way they're measuring the value of these large language models, it's completely, they're all different. They all use different benchmarks. They all use different use cases against these models. So to think you're going to come up with, like, you know, one ring to rule them all sort of thing around how you measure value, And because this is complex, it isn't going to be one thing for everything.
No. Sometimes people try and oversimplify things, don't they? And you know, the devil is in the detail. The reality is often very complex, isn't it? Are you able to share with us a little bit more about what this use case is and the nature of the large language model, or is that a little bit too sensitive to?
I can't really share what the use case was, but it was based on like large amounts of data, I would say, and trying to find patterns within data. So, you know, which is a very, very valid use case, irrespective of what data is you're trying. I mean, that's the one thing is, I think everyone would say is, it's quite interesting. It's like we are literally, there is no shortage of data. The problem being with AI is I think everyone thinks you just point some AI thing at data and it will like, oh yeah. Or obviously if the data's poor or it's not in the right format, it will just give you the same output as a lot of the other stuff we've already got.
So with your experimentation, did you have a particular hypothesis you were testing, and did you have in mind some benefit you were going to get out of that, or was it a bit more dynamic than that? Was it more?
Yeah, it wasn't at the early stages. It wasn't even, we were letting people tell us what the benefit was that they got from it. And once we sort of finished with those 50 people, what we did, we had enough evidence to say, actually, do you know what? There's something here. And we scaled it then to 1,000 people. And we gave 1,000. So again, it was always about doing an experiment, finding the use cases, which the BAs were doing, lots of stakeholder engagement all the way through this, continuous sort of iterative feedback, scale to the next amount of people. We've done that the whole way along, and you know, we're in a position now where it's literally thousands and thousands of people have got access to this. And yeah, the benefit and value people are getting from it are not just time, saving money or productivity. Because again, the saving time thing I find interesting, because it makes it sound like, oh, I've saved an hour of my time today, so that means now I'm sort of, you know, I'm doing yoga down, you know, on the grass outside work because I've got time to do yoga. What are you going to do with that extra hour of time? Well, in reality, you're probably going to be able to solve a problem that you would never have got to by having that extra hour of time. I don't think most companies are going to be telling people, right, we're now going to go and, you know, go to the local petting zoo and spend this afternoon petting animals or something like that with the spare time.
It's interesting, actually, Mick, isn't it? Because I remember, and I've been in my career over 35 years now, so I remember some of the early promises of, oh, we can have so much leisure time because these computers do all this work for us. And actually what's happened is people work harder now than they did before computers because they can achieve more in the same amount of time, and therefore the expectations keep getting higher and higher. Well, actually, now we've saved you this time, you can do all of these other things as well. It's not as if, oh, brilliant, you know, we can take it a bit easier, you know, we can shorten the working day and all of that kind of stuff. I'm not quite sure where I'm going with that, but anyway.
Well, the other effect there is, one of the things we found is, again, I had an interest in it, right? I signed up for ChatGPT. I was literally having a conversation yesterday with a group of people, and I always start off with the same question. Who's used ChatGPT? Because it's the most well-known thing. And still now, at least 25% of the people I was speaking to yesterday didn't have a clue what I was talking about. This thing, this thought that everyone knows what this is and they know how to prompt it or they know how to use it is a complete fallacy as well. There's the amount of engagement and sort of obstacle of people we've had to do is been enormous.
So that's quite a challenge then, isn't it? So there's a big education piece as part of that, your experimentation. You've got to let people know the art of the possible and point them in the right direction so that they've got at least a fighting chance to come up with some decent prompts to get some kind of output. Because if the quality of the prompts is not very good because they don't know what they're doing, they're not going to find a benefit and the thing falls flat. So what sort of approaches, were there things that you did that actually helped them with that?
Yeah, so we actually, again, and this is where BAs were involved, we figured out where this sort of skills gaps was by doing a lot of engagement. We then put a lot of time and effort into doing stuff around prompt engineering. So we ran sessions for people to do prompt. We ran sessions on literally like testing the tech, getting people to come on, giving them a brief. Because it's such a, for a lot of people, it's such a new thing. The only way I can, I mean, I can sort of think, I can remember back to when I very first got a PC put on my desk, right? And it was in 1996, and it was because I was in the army, and somebody we came back in, and there was a PC on the desk. And we were just like all looking at it because we were like, well, we write the daily orders by hand. And someone's like, oh, you can use that. So I can imagine it's that type of thing people go through now. And it can be quite daunting, especially when you, because it's in the media constantly. And obviously what tends to happen is the amplification of the negative stories around this stuff, and people are like, oh my God, I don't want to put anything in that, you know, I don't know what it's going to give me back, because it still does hallucinate, you know, they're getting better, but it's still hallucinates, still got bias in it, all those things still exist. So we did a lot of work face to face, virtually, with hundreds and hundreds of people, to really get them to a level where they thought, I'll just give it a go. I'll play with it. The thing I tell everyone is that you will only get any better at this if you literally play with the technology.
Mm. Yeah, no, I agree. I've myself been writing vigorously for about a year and a half, and I started to think, well, you know, what can it do for me? For starters, it's good for research because it can trawl through a huge amount of data and focus it and just give you what you're interested in, and that saves a huge amount of time. But also things like, you know, if you've got, I mean, many occasions I'd found that I was reading through something I'd written and I thought, well, that doesn't flow very well, there's got to be a better way of putting it. I just popped it into ChatGPT, sorry to drop names there, other AI tools, of course. And I just said, rephrase it. And okay, it didn't come back with brilliant stuff every time, but sometimes I thought, yeah, actually, that's really much better than what I was hoping for. So I think you're right. You've got to almost have the courage to give it a go and not be frightened of it. It's just another tool, isn't it, ultimately?
Well, it is. And one of the examples I always use to people, it's a question I always put in when I'm sort of doing a demo, is... I'm not a quantum physicist, right? I don't claim to be a quantum physicist either. The problem with these large language models is they will tell, when you prompt them, they're going to give you a response. Sometimes they will come back. If it's outside the guardrails of how the model's been designed, it may come back and say, I can't answer that. If you're asking it a very ethical question, I'm going to say, I can't give you an answer to that. But if you ask it most things, it's going to give you an answer, right? And you have to be very aware of that. So one of the things I do is I literally, in front of people, I put into it, explain quantum physics to a nine-year-old, because I've got nine-year-old twins, right? And it explains quantum physics in a way that you think, God, you can explain that to a child. I could explain that to a child. But then the next prompt I put in is, now explain it to a PhD quantum physicist. And then the output, I wouldn't even be able to explain what the equations are. And the reason I do that is to show people there's a limit. You need to know where your level of expertise is when you're using these systems, because if you think you can use these systems to make yourself look clever and as if you've got more knowledge and understanding than you actually have, you will be caught out very, very quickly. Because if you fire this stuff out, someone at some point is going to ask you a question. And I think we're going to get back to almost a system of, I was talking to somebody about this the other day, you know, we all have to bid for work, right? Now, I know a lot of big consultancies now are using AI to help with their bid writing process. And if anyone thinks that's not going on, then they're naive, okay? But the problem is, what's going to happen is all these things, because the way the system works, you're going to get very homogenized bids in front of people. And I think actually what's going to happen and what should happen is instead of just reading a bid, which is what happened most of the time, you are elected on a bid if what someone's read. I think it's going to go back to, no, you have to come and pitch to us. I want to see you explain how you're going to deliver this work, not what you've written there, because I know you've probably used a large language model.
So that sounds like we're taking a different approach there, that rather than using AI to provide the answer, it's providing stuff that we can use, but we have to support it with people who are knowledgeable and capable.
100%.
That's an interesting angle, isn't it? I've not really thought about it in those terms, you know, because in a way it sort of, you know, highlights a little bit the argument is, oh, you know, artificial intelligence is far more intelligent than humans and it's going to take over the world and all that kind of stuff. It's not quite like that, because sometimes you still need, you know, I'm very much a believer in still needing a human in the loop. But it is an interesting angle to think that it may come back with stuff that is beyond my level of understanding and comprehension.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I did a really, I've been getting people to come along to my kids' school to do podcasts, right? They do their own podcast in my kids' school. And we've had some amazing people. And the other day, Dave Snowden came and did it. So if you know who Dave Snowden is, I'm sure most people on the call do. They're, you know, famous for the Canavan framework. I managed to get Rory Sutherland, who was he's the chairman of Ogilvy, to come along. He's written a brilliant book called Alchemy, which is amazing for business analysts. If you want to read that book, it's brilliant. It's got a marketing spin, but very applicable to business analysts. And when Dave Snowden came on the call the other day, did the podcast with the kids, one of the questions the kids asked was around AI. And I've put this on LinkedIn because I took a very small snippet. And what you were saying there, Peter, about it being more intelligent, at the end of the day, it's just a statistical model, right, based on text. And all it's really doing is giving you the next best word that makes sense. And the example I always use is, I say a sentence, I leave the last word off, you tell me what the word is. So if I say, the cat sat on the...
Then we have to match, don't we?
Most people will say that because that's the most common thing. And that's all it's really doing. But what they were explaining to the kids was, us as humans, our decision-making process is only actually based around 10% on text. The rest of it is hearing, seeing, smelling, all the things where we are in situations where we make decisions that an AI can't do that. So, and he was making another really interesting point where in the really expensive schools in America, where a lot of these technology people send their kids, they don't have any of this technology in the class. They've taken it out because they want children to be able to get to a point of being able to think about a problem before they go to an AI-type solution.
It feels like we could talk about this for hours. We could have multiple episodes out of this, but I'm conscious that there are people who probably want to get to sleep at some point. what I'd like to do, me and Pete particularly, because it's getting late now, isn't it, Pete? But what I'd like to do is really sort of come back to think about some of the practical tips you can do, really, and how BAs. Well, how they should approach things, what they can do, how they can get involved.
So a couple of things that I would point people to read about, because it actually shows you a really good case of where BAs are going to be, especially from a government context. So recently the government produced this like AI blueprint, and they produced this AI playbook, right? And in there, it was all talking about things around ethical use, data privacy, using a user-focused iterative approach, using use cases. So the way the government are thinking about AI and implementing it, read those things, because all the language is all the language you see in relation to business analysts. So that's a really good starting point. I mean, there's so many different things you can do with it. There's so many different tools that are out there now that are being used. We had a demo the other day from a company in CMC, and they've got like a rapid prototyping tool that BAs can use, which is really, really helpful. There's stuff around, you know, again, you are literally, you know, you're going to speak to stakeholders. How do we usually do that? We usually sit there and take notes. Well, just take premium, for instance. Now, record the conversation. It gives you a transcript, which it turns into AI-related notes. And what this, one of the benefits of that, and I've got evidence of this where I'm working, because we've got a pilot going on, is it means you can be much more present in the conversation that's taking place without having to worry about missing something that somebody said. I mean, it sounds very minimal, but that has a massive impact on time saving.
It does. In fact, actually, Mick, you've just reminded me, God, that was a bit of a throwback for me, of probably about 20 years ago when we used to teach courses about interviewing and, you know, facilitating workshops and having a dedicated scribe, you know, so that you could focus and engage and do all of that kind of stakeholder piece and the communication and personal skills. To be honest, throughout my entire career, I don't think I've ever had the luxury of a scribe to accompany me on those sorts of discussions. But as a consequence, you do sometimes miss things, don't you? You forget to note them down because your brain is trying to keep up with the conversation and things. But if you can take the pressure off of, you don't need to record all of this, you just have that conversation and you can use the results. And it's not just a case of having to play back the conversation as an audio recording. You know, it's an intelligent way of using, you know, the notes, as you mentioned. You know, they've been, you know, stored in a way that supports AI interrogating and summarising and actually deriving useful information from.
That's a really good example of a tangible time saving that you could have. Well, you can make it tangible if you can use that time for something else, as you said earlier, Mick. Okay, I mean, we've mainly talked about large language models. There are other AI tools out there, so there are things for picture generation, for voice synthesis, and the recording or note taking and summarising. So, any last sort of suggestions? Are there any patterns that you could point people at? Or
well, I mean, I've got loads of links. I've got lots of tabs open here of things that.
Right. Okay. So. I think what we'll do is we'll pull together some of that information and we can put that in the comments for the brew. Anything else from you at all, Pete?
I mean, just to say that I think from a BA perspective that there's kind of two different aspects to this, isn't there? There's one which is how can AI help you be a better BA? But also, how perhaps do you change the nature of being a BA, you know, to embrace the technology and then to start to help organizations to start to deploy that and to get, you know, beneficial outcomes from the use of AI? So I've always seen that there's two different aspects to it. Loads of tools around, as you say, that we can get immediate benefit from. But maybe the longer term sort of issues are still evolving, which is how this change in the nature of the BA role. And maybe that's a subject for another brew sometime. I don't know.
I suspect it probably is. I think there are opportunities for BAs to find out more about it. And the more they find out about it, the more chance or the better position they're in to leverage the benefit of that with their own organizations. And I think that's probably a good point to end on, I think. So I'd like to say thank you to both of you for your comments, and thank you to our audience for joining us today. If you do have any ideas for future episodes of the BA Brew, then please contact us at babrew@assistkd.com, and don't forget to like and subscribe. Thanks a lot, and bye for now.